For this women's weekend, just to reiterate, we had 250 plus ladies here to worship and learn and invest in one another. That's more than we used to have an entire people here on a Sunday just 15 years ago. That's amazing that we could do that. And I want to tag on one additional note. The women's ministry team led by Jill McKenzie is extraordinary to be able to pull off this kind of thing. A church our size, pulling off an event like that is just, it's amazing. They were like ninja Shaolin monks, just dodging spears and blocking stuff and taking care of everything and building and creating. And so all of you ladies who were involved in the development and creation of this weekend, thank you very, very much. It's amazing. Yes, thank you. In this, of course, fallen, already not yet world, just as we celebrate, we also need to take a moment and soberly pray and ask for God's guidance for our world. We've got men and women who are in harm's way around the world right now. We've got an entire nation and another part of the world that we'll actually be talking about this morning in flux, and that we can, no matter what your politics are, we can agree we would love to see these people be able to live in a new level of freedom, maybe for generations to come. And so that will be our prayer this morning. So I hope you'll join me. We actually have students from our church, the Forge students, who many of whom attend here, are headed to Turkey this afternoon to go do their trip that they do, their tour that they do of that part of the understanding the teachings and the travels of the Apostle Paul. And so we want to especially be lifting up their travel as they're traveling even to, they're a long way from it, but it's still that region. So we want to be praying. So if you will, join me. Father, we are so grateful for your goodness and your kindness to us. You're a Father who loves to give good gifts, and this weekend has been a wonderful gift in so many different ways. Thank you. And I pray, Lord, that even from this time that the women of our church inspired to go and make disciples and to learn, continue to learn new things and to pass those on to faithful, other faithful women who could also be able to do the same. And Lord, we're just so grateful for your goodness. We're thankful for your kindness. And Lord, on that note, we also would ask that you would speak in mighty ways. We know that there's an underground church in Iran. And Lord, I pray for them right now that this will create opportunities for them to be able to seek and save the lost. Through the powerful name of your Son and the mighty work of your Spirit. God, I pray that you would have your hand of protection on them as well as on anyone who's trying to do the right thing. God, I pray for your mercies to be poured out in so many different ways. It's a fallen and broken world. That's not changing. We look forward to the day when you will come and make things right. Even so, Lord, come quickly. It's your name we ask these things. Amen. Okay, so we are diving into the next little section. We've been in Isaiah 14 through 24 for several weeks. We're now going to be looking at chapter 21 today. Chapter 21 begins some of the most emotive, dramatic, and poetic of the prophecies we see anywhere in the Bible. It has inspired many different people over the years. Additionally, with the language that is used here, the prophecies we're going to be looking at have been used in movies and books and plays and all types of things throughout the years, and so we're going to get to really kind of understand that even better. It's unique in so many ways, but we'll continue on. This one will continue on for a couple of chapters in this. So we're going to start in chapter 21 of Isaiah, starting in verse 1. The oracle concerning the wilderness of the sea. As whirlwinds and the Negev sweep on, it comes from the wilderness, from a terrible land. All right, so I'll go ahead and stop there. This word oracle, by the way, you've seen it over and over again. In the Hebrew, it just means something that you're carrying that you've got to deliver to somebody else that's heavy. Some of your Bibles will say a burden. Some will say a proclamation or a prophecy, an oracle or an insight. But really, the Hebrew there means God is laying something in Isaiah's lap. It's heavy, and now he's got to carry it and deliver it to others. That's the picture. And the Negev. So the Negev is the desert region in the south and east of Israel. Creatively, Negev means dry land. It's a desert, and so no big surprise. So we're really going to get a proclamation now about a desert, which seems wild to us. Given the context and the places, God is going to offer a proclamation about a region from Babylon into the desert to the south, the Arabian desert, still called that to this day, the Arabian desert. And some of the people groups lived there and the nomadic cultures that are there. These are the descendants of Ishmael we're going to be learning a little bit more about this morning. They moved around the desert as nomads. And that's still, these are the very same people. These are the people groups that modern Arabs are descended from. The Saudis, the Egyptians, and others are descended from these populations. How timely, and again, in the midst of the conversations that we're having around the world now, that this stuff is coming up. The modern Middle East is inhabited by those descended from the ancient Babylonians. That would be kind of Iraq. It's kind of the ancient Babylonians region. You've got the ancient, although really Arabs have mostly taken over that region now. But then you've got the Persians, those descended from the Persians, and that's modern day Iran, which is also part of why there is discontinuity between Iran and some of the other nations, as they literally have their different line of descendants from a different culture. But then also, obviously, the Arabs, those who have descended from these nomadic groups. And I'll give you more history into them as well as we move forward and some of the story about them. So after our conversation last week, guys, this is really interesting. So after looking at the map last week, Craig Gunter texted me and said, well, this is interesting because in the map that you showed that square of where the New Jerusalem would be, not only is Assyria there, not only is Egypt there, but Mecca would fall within that square as well. For those of you who don't know, that's the most holy site of Islam. He said, this is going to be an interesting neighborhood someday when God brings this city into place. Well, okay, so that really made me start thinking, well, that seems odd. So as I was preparing this week about a prophecy that begins in the very desert that Mecca is a part of, I was struck by something that I wanted to check. So Isaiah 14 through 24, for those of you who were here last week, we got to really unpack the beautiful picture of God's redemption of this prophecy, restoring Assyria and claiming them as his people, the Egyptians claiming them as his people, his ability to redeem. There is nowhere we can run. There's nothing we can take in that he can't redeem. And we see this incredible picture. He's going to redeem some of the most powerful enemies of the people of God are someday going to be right there in his holy city. So it made me think. Isaiah 14 through 24 offers proclamations about Assyria, Philistia, Moab, Damascus, Egypt, Cush, the Arabian desert cultures, Babylon, Tyre, and of course, Jerusalem. Turns out it's not a fluke that Assyria and Egypt are there. Check this out. Get our map back up. So we started in Jerusalem, right about here, and we create a square 1,500 miles square. This is actually going to be a giant cube that stretches up into space, but for the sake of the map, a cube that's this big. So that's about a 1,500. This is the holy city described in Revelation 21 and 22 is this big. Okay? So when it's seated, when it comes down from heaven and is seated, presuming its center of the city is Jerusalem, which I think is a fair bet, that's where it's going to land. Assyria, up here. Assyria, Philistia, Moab, Damascus, a little further over here in Syria, Egypt, Cush, the Arabian desert cultures, Babylon up there by the Euphrates, Tyre over by the Mediterranean Sea, and of course Jerusalem. Do it on this side too. Assyria is up here. Philistia is over here near Israel. Moab is too, right over in here. Damascus a little further over in Assyria. What did I leave out? Egypt down here. Cush down here near the curve of the Nile. The Arabian desert cultures. Babylon up by the Euphrates. Tyre by the Mediterranean. And of course, Jerusalem. It isn't that Assyria and Egypt are going to be in the city, it's that all of the cultures and peoples and cities being described in Isaiah 14 to 24, all of them will be in the city. I could find no commentary referencing this. I couldn't find it. I'm sure it's there. But I was blown. I don't even know what to do with this, people. Like, it boggles my mind that this is, but here's what it does. It shows that, once again, remember, one of the main purposes of prophecy is not to send us spiraling in fear. It's exactly the opposite. Oh, yeah, God called this. God said this would be the case. God knew this was coming. God told us this was going to happen this way. This is a beautiful picture of the fact that this isn't just some random act of coincidence that Isaiah 14 through 24, every single culture that receives this promise or these warnings about the last day when the holy city will come out of Jerusalem, they're all inside the city walls. Again, I don't know what to do with that. I guess, a new PhD topic, if I ever decide to get one, there's a thesis ready to go. Scott, we can work on that one, right? Try to unpack the meaning. What is the apologetics meaning of the? I don't know what to say with this, except that once again, it shows the grandeur of God's redemptive power that he's going to put his city right here with these people inside. His redemptive boundaries are bigger than we can imagine. Okay, back to the passage. Chapter 21, I'll start back again. The oracle concerning the wilderness of the sea. As whirlwinds in the Negev sweep on, it comes from the wilderness from a terrible land. Now, like a giant storm. We get that. We understand storms here in East Texas. We get the real thing. We're in Tornado Alley. We understand the idea of scary, life-threatening storms. But even the storms that we experience sometimes, I think maybe don't do justice to what's being pictured here. Isaiah is seeing a prophecy coming like a storm, like a whirlwind. The word here is the same word they use for like tornado. So it's a giant storm of some kind. How serious is this message? Well, if you're in the Arab desert when these storms hit, this is what they look like. That's not a model train town there in the foreground. That's a real city. And that's the sand being blown in by the whirlwind, like God's message coming. These things are so massive, they're visible from space. Our satellites pick up these giant dust storms and sandstorms that happen in this region. So this is a big deal. It's why he goes on to say, it's a stern vision told to me. The traitor betrays and the destroyer destroys. In verse 2, go up, O Elam, lay siege, O Media, all the sighing she has caused I bring to an end. That Hebrew word there, a stern vision, a grievous vision, and even a calamitous vision. This is what's being, the one who does the betraying is now going to be betrayed. The one who does the destroying is now going to be destroyed. Now, certainly, we've heard lots of prophecies about Assyria. Assyria is going to be betrayed and destroyed by Babylon and her allies. But God is jumping past that. He's jumping past that to the next historical round, which is when Babylon itself, the betrayer, is betrayed. When Babylon itself, the destroyer, is destroyed. Not Assyria, but Babylon. We see what he keeps going. He talks about Elam. This is the nation neighbor of Babylon that gets taken over by Persia. Before the exile, typically Hebrew authors refer to Persia with the name Elam. So this is probably just a reference to Persia. In fact, I think that's exactly what it is. And then you have the Medes, the Media. So the Medes, the Medo-Persians, who are the ones who do conquer Babylon. That's what's going to happen. It's intriguing, by the way, at this point in history. This is one of the things that's fascinating. So at this time in history, in the 700s BC, Babylon is a major city, but it's nothing compared to what it's going to be after the rule of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is going to be the one who creates a massive city, unthinkable. We would still walk through the ancient city of Babylon in wonder. We would walk, if it could be rebuilt exactly as it was, we would walk through going like, how did they pull that off? And how'd they do that? And look at this, like the level of crazy opulence and technological advance for its day was amazing. That's though in the future from when Isaiah says this, but I think that's the city that Isaiah is seeing. Isaiah is seeing the grand Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar, the one that the Medo-Persians will take someday. And he is overwhelmed by it. Nothing that Isaiah's ever seen would have even come close to the future city of Babylon. And this, by the way, is a case where I think God delivers prophecies verbally, like auditorily. They hear the message. I think a lot of times, though, what God is doing is he is showing them something. For example, I think the first section of Genesis is best understood as something that God is showing, not telling. And so we certainly, in the book of Revelation, we see that when God is showing John things, not telling him things, and John is just doing his best to describe it. He's doing his best to describe what he's seeing and what he's experiencing. Isaiah is going to be overwhelmed by this. He's going to be stunned by it. In fact, it's going to make him sick. He's going to be almost, he thinks he's dying because of the effect of this. He sees this great massive city, and he sees this wall of sand coming as a message, and then he sees the city destroyed. Here's how he writes this. God is letting him feel it. Therefore, my loins are filled with anguish. Pangs have seized me, like the pangs of a woman in labor. I know this is serious, but I've got to comment on this. So I've told you before, part of why I trust Scripture is because people are still, they're real life people. The people in the Bible are real life people. And men still don't understand the pain of childbearing and yet somehow compare to it sometimes. Like what is Isaiah thinking about? I think this blows me away. He says that, my pangs have seized me like the pangs of a woman in labor. Isaiah, how on earth would you know that, right? Like it's, oh, I'm sure it's just like what women experience. No, probably not. Honestly, buddy, probably not close. I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say that. But anyway, I think it's great. 2,700 years, men have not evolved much, right? So anyway, my loins are filled with anguish. Pains have seized me like the pangs of a woman in labor. I am bowed down so that I cannot hear. I am dismayed so that I cannot see. My heart staggers. Horror has appalled me. The twilight that I longed for has been turned for me into trembling. There's no rest. There's no rest. There's no sleep in this. I am being overwhelmed by this. He's seeing this giant city crushed. People dying. Horror happening. We know how this happened. We actually know. We've discussed it before. The great city of Babylon, unconquerable. The Medo-Persians gathered outside the walls, and the idiot King Belshazzar decides to throw a giant party in the midst of this moment, and he gathers all of the holy relics from the temple, maybe from a lot of temples, but from the temple in Jerusalem that's been captured. He gathers together all the gold and silver vessels that are used for worshiping God, and he uses those to serve his wine at his giant party. That's when the hand shows up. The writing on the wall literally shows up to warn him he's done. It's over with. And that night, the Medo-Persians sneak in through the river valley that runs through Babylon and take the city. And you listen to the language, you can tell he's seeing this. He describes it, and it feels to me like he's describing something like we would just in a horror movie. That you're watching a horror movie, and the person is opening the door, and you're like, don't open the door, right? Like, no, don't do it. And you can hear, I think that's exactly what we're reading here, is God revealing something to him, and him saying like, no, don't. Don't trust it. It's not, you're not safe. Don't do it. Verse 5. They prepare the table. They spread the rugs. They eat and they drink. Arise, O princes, oil your shields. For thus the Lord says to me, go, set a watchman. Let him announce what he sees. When he sees riders, horsemen in pairs, riders on donkeys, riders on camels, let them listen diligently, very diligently. Listen, they need to be listening. They're not paying a good enough attention. The watchmen are not paying attention. Then he who saw the watchman cried out, upon a watchtower I stand, O Lord, continually by day, and at my post I am stationed whole nights. And behold, here come the riders, horsemen in pairs. And he answered, fallen, fallen is Babylon. And all the carved images of her gods he has shattered to the ground. Babylon is fallen in his vision. And it will fall this way 150 or more years from the time the prophecy is given to Isaiah. It will fall just in this way by the Medes and the Persians, who also weren't a great power at the time of the prophecy. And remember, this is the thing, this proclamation that God is telling Isaiah, this is what's going to happen. Right now, you're all scared of them. Right now, they are the betrayer. Right now, they are the destroyer. But there will come a time when they, in fact, will themselves be destroyed. And the proclamation that God has, so it centers up there on Babylon. It's like his proclamation begins to drift south into the Arabian desert, drifting south from the Tigris and Euphrates. It's important for us to remember that the Jews are people of the land. As Texans, we're a little more that than most Americans and than most Westerners. But this idea that the land is significant, the land matters. It's a concept that we really can't fully grasp from the Jewish perspective, but we need to try to. I would love to encourage some of you who are life group leaders and teachers and whatever, I would really encourage you, sometime when you're going to be teaching a new class or you start up something new, take a location and teach the location. We do word studies all the time. We do book studies all the time. And we even do character studies all the time. And that's what some of us are doing with our students at Sunday nights. But if you've never taught a location study where you've said, I'm going to teach through the Bible, through the lens of Bethlehem. Beginning to ending, the story of Bethlehem. That's how they think. They think in those terms. When they show up somewhere, they're expecting the narrative to go a certain way because each location has its own narrative. It has its own story, and they link to that. When stories start somewhere, I mean, you can imagine you could do it with Jerusalem, massive, right? Shechem, Shiloh. These locations are key to them. What is the significance of it? So that would be a great thing to study at some point, to dig through it, because they see it that way. We have a hard time with it. The Jews are people of the land, and they think in terms of the land. So I'm going to show you, just so you'll have in your mind, our brains can't quite do what theirs would do, moving from place to place as these places and people are named, but I'm going to give you a shot. So we've got a map. It's not a great one, but we're going to go with it. You can see Babylon up there on the Euphrates River, and then the vision is going to head south, and you're going to hear places mentioned, the Kedar and Dedan, Arabia, Elam, Seir. These are the places that you're going to hear described. These aren't really places, as I'll explain in a moment. So as I'm reading through it, this will allow your brain to kind of like, okay, we're in the Saudi Arabian desert here. Verse 10, oh, my threshed and winnowed one, what I have heard from the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, I announce to you, the oracle concerning Duma. One is calling to me from Seir. Watchman, what time of the night? Watchman, what time of the night? So here we have the image. Isaiah gives us the image in the midst of the storm of a watchman in Seir. So Seir, again, was over there. It's the descendants, the home of the Edomites, the descendants of Esau, the brother of Jacob. These are the tribes that live just to the south and east of Israel. Sometimes cause problems. And in the area of the Dead Sea. So they're up here north, really north and kind of west of the Arabian Desert. But Duma, this is one of the sons of Ishmael. You can look up the sons of Ishmael in Genesis 25. By the time of the writing of Isaiah, they were a large nomadic people group, a large nation of nomads. And they wandered around the Arabian Desert and its edges. Remember, this is the history of the Abrahamic people. Abraham was a nomad. He was like a Bedouin chieftain, a super powerful and scary one. He was Abraham's family and traveling group. We don't know how big it was, but it was huge. He had thousands of cattle and sheep and all the things that they would wander through the desert together in this massive group. Abraham's group was so big and powerful that established nations like Egypt got nervous when Abraham's family came near in their nomadic cycles. When five kings conquer Sodom and Gomorrah and others, and they take everyone away and run off, Abraham alone with his army, his own personal armies, chase down through Canaan. They chase down these five armies, and defeat them by themselves, just Abraham and his armies. That's how powerful a nation Abraham represented. Well, his descendants, through Ishmael, or as you'll see, through Keturah, they are still nomads at the time of Isaiah. They don't have an established town, established place. Israel, the sons of Israel do, but so the Bedouin Arabs. So the watchman is calling through the storm to each other. What time of the night is it? What watch are we on? The watchman then says, verse 12, the watchman says, morning comes, and also the night. If you will inquire, inquire, and come back again. This is the oracle. In other words, they're lost. This region, these people, the people of Duma, the people of Seir, they're lost, and they're turning to one another, and they're not going to be found. verse 13, the oracle concerning Arabia. In the thickets of Arabia you will lodge, O caravans of Dedanites. So here, Arabia, of course we know, south and east of Israel, just like today. The Dedanites are another nomadic culture from the Arabian deserts. These are the descendants, some of you may not know this, a little bit sketchy. So Abraham, of course, had his wife Sarah, but he also had at least one child through Hagar, Sarah's servant. That's Ishmael. And that's a very dark story, and there are lots of prices, lots of consequences for this faithless sin on the part of Abraham and Sarah, and their abuse of her handservant. Then you also have, when Sarah dies, if you can imagine it, Abraham remarries. I don't know how old he is at this point, but he's in his early 100s. He then marries another woman and has several children with her, Keturah. And one of those children is Dedan. And these are the descendants of that woman through Abraham and that woman. This is the Dedanites. Verse 14. To the thirsty, bring water. Meet the fugitive with bread, O inhabitants of the land of Timnah. For they have fled from the swords, from the drawn sword, from the bent bow, from the press of battle. So they're getting chased around too, probably by the Assyrians or the Babylonians. For thus the Lord said to me, within a year, according to the years of a hired worker, all the glory of Kedar will come to an end. And the remainder of the archers of the mighty men of the sons of Kedar will be few, for the Lord, the God of Israel, has spoken. So you get this again, the picture, these nomadic cultures. Kedar was another one of the sons of Ishmael, and this had become a large nomadic culture in that area. In fact, you can just take a second. I'll make sure y'all just know, in case you don't, I mentioned this. But these are the Ishmael is considered to be the father, the forefather of the Muslim nations. Now, that's actually not always true. He is the forefather of the Arabic nations, which in today's world certainly are mostly Muslim. But the, like I said, the Iranians, that's going to be mostly Persian. The Babylonians are where you're going to, the Iraqis are largely, many of them are descendants from the Babylonians, and then others from the Assyrians and others in that region. But this is significant. If you've ever read the Quran, you may not know this, that the story of Abraham choosing Isaac, Abraham being the son of the promise, the way that's told in the Quran is essentially the same way, except with the names reversed. Ishmael is the chosen son of Abraham through whom the promise will run, not Isaac. That's what's in the Quran, which was written much, much later, 600 years, at the earliest 600 years after the New Testament was being put together. So you're talking about much less, much, much later after the Old Testament, 1,000 years later. So this is the picture that's created there, and that's why they would say they are the actual descendants of Abraham, not the Jews. That they are the actual, those who are supposed to inherit the promise, not the Jews. That's the picture there, so you'll know. Kedar is another one of those sons, but you can see all these nomadic peoples are being squeezed. They're losing power. We don't know much about them. Nomadic people don't leave much behind. They don't leave writings behind. They don't leave cities behind. They don't leave coins behind. They don't leave much behind, so we don't know much about these people because they either don't exist or they are the modern Arab cultures. It's why when you see the Saudis today, that may be weird to Americans, that when you see the Saudis, they come out in their traditional garb and they're wearing these robes, these long, big, heavy robes. And you're like, wow, that's wild that they would wear all that. That's because they live in the desert. So, you know, we think in terms of like, oh, we should wear less clothes when you're hot so that you can be cooler. Well, yeah, that's fine so long as you have enough to drink, etc. The truth, though, is in a desert, you're being basted alive. The water's being cooked out of your body all the time. And so, you're going to sweat. You go like, gosh, wearing all those big, heavy robes are going to make you sweat. Well, I mean, you're sweating one way or another. Those big, heavy robes hold the water, the liquid from your own skin against your skin. It keeps you alive. You're not having it cooked out of you constantly. So, yeah, you're going to be hot and miserable. That's called being in the desert. They all are, that's going to be the case. They've got these, and now they don't have to wear that, obviously. They've got, after we all discovered, fossil fuels, and that's power, and discovered that there was a lot of it under the sand there in the Arabic desert. Yeah, they don't have to. They've got air conditioning and all those other things too as well now, but that's their tradition. Their tradition is to dress in that with the head coverings and that kind of stuff. That's a lot of that is Arabic tradition. Okay, so that's who we're talking about. The valley, this is what we're about to see. The next week, the oracle is going to be the valley of vision, which is going to be about Jerusalem, God's chosen people. It's interesting that Babylon and the Arabic desert peoples are here poetically referred to as the desert of the sea. There's a lot of debate on why that's there. One may just be it's like a giant ocean. The desert is so big, it's like a sea. It may be because it's surrounded by seas, this desert, the Mediterranean on one side, and the Persian Gulf, and the Red Sea, and all that kind of stuff is all around this desert. Maybe that's what's being described here. Or maybe that the Tigris and Euphrates is this beautiful, lush land, and then everything to the south of it is desert. No one really knows for sure, but it is very poetic, and it's going to continue to be. This phrase, the wilderness of the sea, fallen is Babylon. Throughout years, any indulgent culture is called Babylon. Some of you may have watched movies about or read books about the fact that in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, the growing power of Hollywood was often referred to as the New Babylon. It's where indulgence was the rule. There were no rules. This is what you do whatever you want to do. You take whatever you want to take. You engage with whatever you want to engage with. And over the years, in fact, Babylon has become the symbol for exactly that. Babylon becomes the symbol for the very best that the world has to offer. Wealth, power, sex, intoxication, adventure, novelty, innovation, abuse, magic, advances, education, art. All of those things, some of which are good things in the proper setting and in the proper place. This continues all the way from the very beginning of the Bible to the very end. In Revelation 14, the Apostle John is watching the angels do the work of judgment on the earth. And starting in verse 6, then I saw another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim, an eternal good news to proclaim to those who dwell on earth, to every nation and tribe and language and people. And he said with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. And worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water." I know we don't like the word judgment, but the truth is, of course, for God's people, judgment is good news. That's not bad news, that's good news. He's about to make things right. That's what we can't wait for him to make things right around here, right? That's the proclamation of God's goodness, his gospel to the whole world. Look to God instead. Look to God. This is the message of the first messenger to the whole world. But in verse 8, look, another angel, a second following, saying, "Fallen. Fallen is Babylon the Great." The identical quote, right? Straight from Isaiah. "She who made all the nations drink the wine of her passion, of the passion of her sexual immorality." Happens again in chapter 18 of Revelation, starting in verse 1. "After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory. And he called out with a mighty voice, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. For all nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living." Self-indulgent living, the humanist mindset that we are the best that it can possibly be, and what we do is the best that it can possibly be, is this worldview. And of course, church, the world has some amazing stuff to offer, but it also, it's amazing how quickly it can become so dark. There's almost no fantasy you cannot indulge here. Here you can dump out pain on others. There's no worldly thing you can't achieve. And we pat ourselves on the back and call it amazing. I'm no anti-technology type person at all. I like my antibiotics. I'm good with that, right? But we have this mindset that so quickly we go, look at what we can do. You know what we ought to do? You know what we could do? We could build a tower all the way to God, and we could take over. We could be our own gods. We could be the divine ones. We don't need anything above us. We should be at the apex. You may not know, but most scholars believe that the story of the Tower of Babel begins in the original city of Babylon itself. This has always been the best mankind has to offer. From the beginning, it has represented the tower of mankind's achievement and pride. Every unclean spirit and intoxicating thing is available in Babylon, if that's what you want. But you know what? We know something else about Babylon. It falls. It always does. It fails us, each and all, over and over. If you were here for the women's weekend, you got to hear testimonies. And we don't use this language a lot. We don't have a testimony where we go, and Babylon fell. But that's what we're saying. I was at a men's conference here in town, hearing the testimonies of men, and they were saying the same thing. Here's what I looked to give me purpose and meaning and value and even just a sense of experiencing life. And guess what? It fell. It fell apart on me. It falls and it always does. At the very beginning it fell. 2,700 years ago-ish, God warned us that it would fall. It has continued to fall. And he tells us instead to invest in the eternal goodness, the good news, the powerful gospel, investing in the one that can give actual meaning, true significance. And listen, this isn't some sales job. I don't always like what that means either. I don't always love what God takes us through. I don't always love the way God leads us and guides us. I don't like valleys and wildernesses either. But he doesn't fall. And his promises to us will stand. The word of the Lord will stand forever. He is eternal. So that's why we follow the teaching of the angel to worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water, the very things that actually give us comfort, that actually give us provision. That's what we look to. If you will, stand together. We want to take a moment and focus our attention in on what God's been saying through his word. That this is the case. If you've been through our welcome home process and you're ready to come and join this dysfunctional family, we would love for you to come do that this morning. We'd love to celebrate that. But more importantly, if you've heard that this is the actual calling of the purpose of what it means for us to be human, is to call to him, to look to him, to pray to him, to ask for his guidance and leadership. Maybe you recognize you've been building your life on the wrong thing. You've been climbing the wrong ladder. The structure that you've built, it's just waiting to fall. You're trusting in something other than him for that. I hope you'll come, either pray where you are, or you will come up here and pray with one of these. And if that means I've heard the gospel and I realize there is a God who's calling upon me to worship him as one of his children who he has loves and who he has chosen, and I want to put my faith in him, boy, we'd love nothing more than that to get to do that and have that prayer with you. We would love that. Whatever it is that you would listen to what the Spirit is leading you in, that you could come and pray, we're either there or here, whatever it happens to be. That everything else we put our faith in, which is typically ourselves, it will fall, just like Babylon. I'm gonna wrap up this little bit of our time with this passage from Ephesians chapter 4. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Listen to this next verse. Wherever you are in your heart, be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ forgave you. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children. Walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and a sacrifice to God. The very words of the Lord.